disastrous effects of the Great Leap Forward, and in an effort to regain power, Mao called upon the youth of the nation to revive the revolutionary spirit by purging impure elements of Chinese society. Schools were shut down, and student paramilitary groups, known as the Red Guards, were created to harass the elderly and intellectuals. Gangs of children roamed the streets in search of enemy offenders. Placards were placed around offenders' necks, dunce caps put on their heads, and people were paraded into public squares to be humiliated and beaten. Red Guards destroyed libraries and museums. Communist leaders who challenged Mao were removed from power and imprisoned. Items associated with wealth, high-heeled shoes, furs, silk gowns, were confiscated and burned in bonfires in the streets. Hospitals and courts closed down. Chaos ensued, and the economy plummeted. By 1969, the country was in shambles. The Red Guards fought among themselves, and executions became widespread. It was entropy manifest, raw struggle. What puzzled analysts at CIA was that the years from 1962 to 1978 were a dead zone for Qigong in China. Not a word about Qigong appeared in print. Then came a single article about Tang Yu in 1979. It appeared as if emerging out of a vacuum. That the article triggered such intense interest across China was remarkable in the eyes of CIA and DIA. There had to be something else going on, someone responsible for the sudden adulation of a practice that had been forbidden for 15 years. When CIA analysts dug deep, what they discovered was astonishing. The man at the center of it all, from Qigong to the concept of extraordinary human body function, was Chen Husen, formerly one of the most valuable members of the U.S. military science intelligentsia, now a sworn enemy of the United States. Chen Husen, or H.S. Chen as he was known in America, was an American rocket pioneer. Born in China in 1911, he left for the United States in 1935, aged 24, on a Boxer Rebellion indemnity scholarship. He first attended college at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where he studied electrical engineering, then transferred to the California Institute of Technology, Caltech, to study under Theodore von Karman, the world-famous aerospace engineer. Starting in the late 1930s, Chen worked on early American rocket designs, and in 1938, co-founded the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California, America's first experimental rocket laboratory. So brilliant was Chen that von Karman declared him an undisputed genius. During World War II, Chen was granted the U.S.'s highest security clearance in order to work on the Manhattan Project, where he helped build the world's first atomic bomb. Commissioned as a colonel in the U.S. Army Air Force, he applied to become an American citizen, but his paperwork languished during the war. After the Nazis surrendered, Chen traveled to occupied Germany, where he interrogated Werner von Braun, the world's first famous rocket scientist. In 1949, still waiting for his U.S. citizenship to be granted, Chen was made the first director of what was officially called the Guggenheim Jet Propulsion Center at Caltech, which today is NASA's leading center for robotic exploration of the solar system. Then, on October 1, 1949, owing to faraway events entirely beyond his control, H.S. Chen's life changed course forever. When Mao Zedong officially proclaimed the existence of the People's Republic of China in the fall of 1949, China and the United States became enemies. The loss of China to communism was a severe blow to America, and H.S. Chen's life would never be the same. 8 months later, on June 6, 1950, the FBI knocked on his door. It was the McCarthy era, and he was still a Chinese national, since his U.S. citizenship had not yet been granted. The Bureau's representatives demanded that he answer questions about possible communist ties. Chen was insulted. How could these FBI bureaucrats not realize who he was in the context of U.S. national security and the kind of security clearances he held? The FBI's response was to revoke his coveted clearances and place him under house arrest. After 5 humiliating years of quasi-detention, Chen was returned to China as part of a Korean prisoner of war exchange. He spent the rest of his life avenging his treatment by the United States. The story of H.S. Chen exemplifies the curious flexibility of personal conviction. Chen was betrayed by the United States, the country whose ideals he believed in and which he'd served during the war. America was the land he called home. And yet, by the time he arrived in China in October 1955, his belief system and his loyalties had been transposed 180 degrees, as though flipped by a switch. He remained a committed communist for the rest of his life and would earn the rare distinction of becoming a science advisor to Chairman Mao. Science was to be H.S. Chen's weapon of revenge against the United States. Almost single-handedly, he revolutionized China's technological capabilities from bare bones to cutting edge. He created and developed the Chinese rocket program, its satellite program, and its manned space program. His work on China's atomic bomb project allowed that nation to produce nuclear weapons and their delivery systems. Further, he was deeply committed to the science behind anomalous mental phenomena, including extrasensory perception, psychokinesis, and teleportation. His story has been remarkably underreported to date. When Chen returned to China in October 1955, China's industrial development was primitive, with barely the technology to build a decent automobile. The most common forms of travel were bicycle and rickshaw. And so, even before Chen arrived in Beijing, he'd been cast as a hero. His return, brokered between Communist Party officials and the U.S. State Department, was seen as a victory for the Chinese. In Beijing, the scientific elite was in awe of him, and it was firmly believed that Chen would pull China from the technological dark ages into the modern world. Lavish banquets commemorating his homecoming were thrown at the Chinese Academy of Science and Beijing University. Within a few months of his arrival, the government created the Institute of Mechanics in Beijing and installed him as director. At the time, there was but one telephone. Technicians used hand-crank calculators. But Chen was off and running, deeply invested in continuing his life work, only now in service of Communist China. In Chen's first year back in China, as part of the Great Leap Forward, Mao instituted an unusual policy called Let 100 Flowers Bloom. Intellectuals were encouraged to criticize the Communist Party, to say whatever they want and say it in full, according to a statement by the chairman. The policy actually was a plot to root out dissent, and as a result, hundreds of thousands of critics were punished, tortured, or killed. Having witnessed McCarthyism, Chen kept his head down remained silent and did not make waves. He traded in his Western clothes for the standard gray uniform of the party. He denounced colleagues and promoted Communist Party doctrine. There were benefits for steadfast loyalty, and Chen earned such rewards. He was moved into a guarded compound in the Haidian district of Beijing and promoted to director of the Fifth Academy, where he led China's top-secret missile program. On November 5, 1960, the Chinese version of the Soviet R-2 rocket was launched, and a huge celebration was given in his honor. It was a turning point in China's history. A modern rocket had flown. Chen was now put in charge of the party's ambitious plan to build China's first generation of land-based ballistic missiles, the Dongfeng, East Wind. He developed China's satellite program, consulted on China's first nuclear program, and in February 1964 became Chairman Mao's private science tutor. On October 27, 1966, China became the first nation to deploy a missile with a live atomic warhead in its nose cone, an act internationally condemned as reckless. The man believed responsible for the first test of its kind was trained, nurtured, encouraged, lionized, paid, and trusted for 15 years in the United States, noted a New York Times reporter. But science in China would come under attack during the Cultural Revolution. In an effort to sound pro-proletariat, the Fifth Academy changed its name to the Seventh Ministry of Machine Building, and Chen was removed from the position of director. He remained one of what are believed to be only 50 scientists protected by the state during this time. He quietly worked on a classified program involving manned spaceflight, and in April 1968, spearheaded the formation of the 507th Research Institute, also known as the Beijing Institute of Space Medical Engineering. In 1972, Mao suffered a stroke, and the moderate Deng Xiaoping took control of the government. In 1976, Mao died. With Deng Xiaoping now officially in power, China began steps toward reform. Science returned to the limelight, and H.S. Chen once again became its mouthpiece, this time for the new government. Here began a mysterious transition that the U.S. intelligence community sought to understand. With his reemergence into the spotlight, Chen became a vocal advocate of extraordinary human body functioning, ESP, PK, and Qigong. He was the man behind the emergence of phenomena research, and he did it almost single-handedly. After the publication of the article about Tang Yu and the extraordinary powers craze, the Chinese opened a classified research institute dedicated to the study of anomalous mental phenomena. It was located inside the Beijing Institute of Space Medical Engineering under the leadership of H.S. Chen. It was here that China's leading scientists began developing military applications for exceptional functions of the human body, extrasensory perception, and psychokinesis. Decades of rocket research had left Chen with a deep conviction that there existed a symbiotic relationship between outer space and inner space, between the cosmos and man. The link, he said, was qi. What for 2,000 years was considered a mysterious ancient form of Chinese medicine could now be understood in the language of modern scientific technology, Chen told a gathering of Communist Party leaders in June 1981. Citing laboratory experiments with EHBF teenagers who demonstrated sight not by eyes, i.e. ESP, and influenced animate or inanimate objects, i.e. PK, Chen said that researching the energy powered by the vital force of qi would lead to the next scientific revolution. There were military advantages to be had. In time of war, the body in a state of EHBF is beneficial, declared the father of China's rocket program. This enthusiastic atmosphere in China reminds us of the same atmosphere when Einstein's theory of relativity and quantum mechanics were introduced onto the stage of modern science, he said. The only difference is that the stage at that time was Western Europe, and now the stage is the People's Republic of China. In Washington, D.C., the Defense Intelligence Agency wanted a first-hand assessment of what was going on in China with these EHBF teenagers, H.S. Chen, and the various labs involved. Arrangements were made to send Hal Putoff to China in a clandestine capacity as a contractor on the special access program, Grill Flame. In October 1981, a delegation of 18 American and Canadian researchers, scientists, and journalists traveled to China to meet EHBF scientists and researchers under the auspices of civilian interest in psychic research. Putoff was a member of the delegation, working undercover for DIA. The 12-day trip included visits to Beijing, Shang, and Shanghai. In Beijing, the group visited military science facilities at the Chinese Academy of Sciences and the Institute of High Energy Physics. Upon his return, Putoff prepared a 60-page classified report entitled Psychoenergetics Research in the People's Republic of China, 1982, now declassified. He confirmed the experiments, met many of the scientists, and observed the modern equipment being used in China's laboratories. H.S. Chen has been the driving force behind establishing EHBF science, Putoff wrote, cautioning DIA not to underestimate his power and influence. He is thought to have had a major role in developing China's first nuclear bombs. The report was sent to Dr. Jack Verona at DIA for review. The goals of the psychic research program had always been to evaluate the threat that foreign psychoenergetics achievements might pose to U.S. national security and to explore the potential of psychoenergetics use in U.S. intelligence collection. The threats from foreign governments had previously been limited to the Soviet Union and its Warsaw Pact nations. Now, China was added to that list. A potential threat to U.S. national security exists from foreign achievements in psychoenergetics in the USSR and China, a declassified memo made clear. This research is well-funded and receives high-level government backing. At the Pentagon, Putoff's report was sent to Richard DeLauer, Undersecretary of Defense for Research and Engineering. DeLauer had attended Caltech, H.S. Chen's alma mater, and was aware of the power and influence wielded by the man he called the elder statesman of Chinese scientific technology and development. 3 months after receiving the report and a backup briefing, DeLauer signed a memo allocating additional resources, Program 6 funds, for the psychic research program, Grill Flame. There was an interesting story unfolding in California around this same time. It appeared anecdotal at first, but would come to have significance. In 1983, not many Americans were familiar with the ancient Chinese concepts of qi and qigong, and far fewer knew anything about the Chinese rocket scientist H.S. Chen. But in Manhattan Beach, a systems engineer for Boeing Aerospace named Jack Hauk was familiar with both. He saw a connection between chi and psychokinesis that no one in America had really considered before. Observing Uri Geller bend spoons on TV and reading reports of children being inspired by Geller to bend spoons in their homes, allegedly using the power of their minds, got Jack Hauk thinking. During the process, people often said they felt energy coming from their hands, Hauk stated. He also noted that several local martial arts practitioners he knew also spoke of an internal energy they could summon with their minds and that was felt as heat in their hands. They call it chi, said Hauk. As an aerospace engineer, Jack Hauk was interested in the concept of bending metal with the mind. He began having discussions with a colleague from McDonnell Douglas Aerospace Company, a metallurgist named Severin Dahlin. Hauk and Dahlin wondered whether the ability to bend metal this way had something to do with one's belief system. Perhaps psychokinesis was not a so-called paranormal superpower, but an ability to harness the energy force the Chinese called qi that was latent in all people. As an experiment, Hauk decided to host a spoon bending party with 21 people at his Manhattan Beach home in January 1981. If any of the spoons were bent, Dahlin would analyze the results from a metallurgist's point of view. The two scientists created a three-step protocol for guests at the party. 1. Make a mental connection to what you want to affect, bend. 2. Command what you want it to do by shouting, bend, bend, bend. 3. Let go. The let go part, Hauk explained, meant allowing your mind to let go of the idea that it is impossible to bend metal with the mind. In the first experiment, to test the conceptual model, we had regular, average folks. Half of the people were interested in psychic-type things. The other half were members of a tennis club I belonged to, Hauk recalled. Unlike a martial arts setting in which the practitioner concentrates silently, Hauk and Dahlin wanted to create a high-energy environment of excitement with everyone shouting, bend. This one young boy, 14, had his fork fall over, Hauk wrote. Everyone in the room saw it because he jumped up out of his chair screaming. Hauk said that what happened next was particularly fascinating. Most of the people in the room had what I call an instant belief system change. Everyone's fork or spoon started to get soft for 5 to 15 seconds. In that window of time, says Hauk, 19 out of the 21 spoons or forks bent. Hauk began hosting spoon bending parties. The results were almost always the same. Roughly 85% of the spoons bent. Dahlin, the metallurgist, tested the bent spoons in the lab. His conclusion, stainless flatware seemed to be the easiest metal to bend with PK. This is because of the metallurgical characteristics of stainless steel. Stainless flatware is usually stamped out in large quantities. The process of cold stamping creates a large number of dislocations along the grain boundaries in the metal. The PK energy is somehow dumped into the metal, and these dislocations act as beacons for that energy. Once the PK energy lands at a dislocation, there is nowhere for it to go, and it turns into heat, much as when neutrons and X-rays penetrate solid objects. At his spoon bending parties, Hauk watched hundreds, then thousands, of average Americans suspend their disbelief and bend metal without physical force. Yes, it's likely that some percentage of the guests cheated. But hundreds of them bent hacksaw blades, silver-plated serving spoons, and 5/16-inch steel rods that are physically impossible to bend by hand. By the time Hal Putoff's paper on psychoenergetics research in China was making its rounds at DIA, Jack Hauck had hosted more than 50 PK parties, attended by approximately 1,000 individuals. His conclusion was that everyone seems to be able to do PK. Metal often continues to bend for up to 3 days. This seems to correlate well with the qi energy discussed in various martial arts disciplines. Naturally, there were military implications in what Jack Hauck had unveiled, and soon he would be contacted by the U.S. Army Intelligence and Security Command. Chapter 16. Killers and Kidnappers. On March 30, 1981, just 70 days after becoming president, Ronald Reagan was shot and seriously injured in an assassination attempt in Washington, D.C. As the president was leaving a speaking engagement at the Hilton, the assassin, John Hinckley Jr., was able to fire 6 bullets in the direction of the presidential entourage, striking President Reagan with a single shot. It was a perilously close call. The president's left lung was punctured, and he suffered heavy internal bleeding. The attempted assassination was the first time a bullet had hit a sitting U.S. president since John F. Kennedy had been killed in Dallas 18 years before. 2 months later in Rome, in St. Peter's Square, Vatican City, an assassin opened fire on Pope John Paul II, the leader of 600 million Roman Catholics around the world. 4 bullets hit the pontiff, 2 lodged in his abdomen, another hit his left index finger, and another his right arm. The Pope underwent more than 5 hours of surgery and survived. That fall, on October 6, 1981, Egyptian President Anwar el-Sadat was assassinated by Islamic fundamentalists in Cairo, an event that stunned the world. Sadat had been watching a military victory parade when a group of men in uniform threw grenades and fired assault rifles at him. Mortally wounded, Sadat was airlifted to a military hospital and died 2 hours later. In a span of roughly 7 months, there had been 3 assassination attempts against world leaders, with 3 direct hits and 1 death. The perceived vulnerability of international figures escalated to alarming proportions. The day after Sadat was murdered, newspapers across America and around the world hinted at future assassination plots against President Reagan. The Secret Service tightened protocols, and the FBI was placed on high alert. Across the intelligence community, analysts were assigned a variety of threat assessments, both foreign and domestic. At CIA and DIA, intelligence officers learned of a plot by Colonel Muammar Gaddafi to send Libyan hit squads to kill President Reagan and members of his cabinet. The president began traveling in an unmarked limousine. Secret Service members were assigned to protect National Security Council staff. A pair of surface-to-air missiles was installed on the White House roof. The CIA learned of a second presidential assassination plot, this one spearheaded by the international terrorist Carlos the Jackal, who was thought to have already entered the United States. All kinds of intelligence collection were called up to thwart assassination plots, including human intelligence, signals intelligence, imagery intelligence, open source intelligence, and the Detachment G remote viewers at Fort Meade. In Washington, Dale Graff had just begun his new job working for Jack Verona, Assistant Vice Director for Scientific and Technical Intelligence at DIA. Graff moved to the nation's capital and rented an apartment not far from his office, on the far side of Arlington National Cemetery. Barbara stayed behind in Dayton, where she worked as the head nurse at St. Elizabeth Hospital. She and the children would join him the following year. Graff's role as Verona's action officer was to oversee both the SRI research in Northern California, now being financed by DIA, and the Grill Flame operation at Fort Meade. With the assassination threat level heightened, Graff traveled back and forth between Arlington and Fort Meade, where he worked with the information provided by remote viewers and tried to develop protocols to separate signal from noise. The information was voluminous, and much of it was noise. For example, Fort Meade psychics drew sketches of would-be assassins that were male and female and ranged in age from 18 to 65. Some had black hair, others wore wigs. Some had brown eyes, others had altered their eye color with contact lenses. Still others wore glasses. One remote viewer was certain of an assassin who, always dressed in natural tones and wore brown shoes. Almost all of the remote viewers perceived an assassin carrying a 9mm automatic pistol. Descriptions of getaway vehicles included a Chrysler, a Ford, a light blue sedan, and a purple GMC van with gold trim, black interior, and carpeting on the seats. The remote viewers pinpointed dozens of locations on maps around Washington, where they individually intuited that an assassination attempt might occur. The information was as overwhelming as it was nebulous. Where to begin? Day in and day out, deciphering the information and devising a plan of action was Dale Graff's greatest challenge. Given the critical nature of the operation, Grill Flame's ancillary support team at SRI was brought in on the high-priority effort. Staff at SRI consisted of two senior scientists, a research analyst, a consultant, and several support personnel. Normally, the remote viewers at SRI worked on research programs. Now, they too were shifted to operational status. As data from the SRI viewers came in, Graff examined it. On the afternoon of December 12, 1981, Hal Putoff was working with remote viewer Gary Langford, the former naval officer who'd provided information on the Zaire operation and the missing Soviet bomber. In this particular session, Putoff asked Langford to determine if an event of major importance to the United States will occur in the near future. Langford worked the question for several days, with no clear impressions coming in, he said. Then, 3 days later, on December 15th, at 8:37 a.m., during a session identified in declassified CIA documents as Task Identification 0049, one of the most spectacular apparent instances of extrasensory perception intelligence in the history of the program occurred. Out of Langford's mouth came a prophecy. A United States Pentagon official would be kidnapped by terrorists on the evening of 17 December 1981. The information was so specific in terms of date and time, and Langford was so assertive in relaying this information, that Putoff ran several additional sessions with him to try to learn more. Langford said he saw the terrorists breaking into this Pentagon official's apartment, binding and gagging the man, and then kidnapping him. Even more specifically, Langford saw this high-ranking official being shoved inside a trunk and secreted in the back of a van. The kidnappers were Mediterranean-looking, Langford said, and the van was blue with some kind of strange markings on the side. He drew a sketch of the trunk and its dimensions. Putoff alerted Dale Graff. The DIA passed Putoff's information to the FBI, which issued a threatened kidnapping alert against a federal official. The International Criminal Police Organization was alerted, and by the next morning, Interpol had issued a worldwide counterterrorism alert. At 5:30 on the evening of December 17, 1981, Brigadier General James L. Dozier, a senior Army official and deputy chief of staff in the NATO Southern Command, was sitting in his penthouse apartment on Strada Lunga di Catania in Verona, Italy, with his wife Judy when the doorbell rang. Dozier, age 50, was a graduate of West Point, a Vietnam War veteran, and a recipient of the Silver Star. He had been reading a letter when the doorbell rang. He stood up and walked toward the door. Interviewed in 2015, Dozier recalled thinking the situation was odd. The bell was the one that rang when pushed from inside the building, here on the top floor, not down on the street. The Doziers weren't expecting visitors, but perhaps it was a neighbor, Dozier recalled. "Qui est?" Dozier asked. "Who's there?" A man on the other side of the door addressed him as Generale and identified himself as a plumber. "There was a leak in the building," the voice said. "Could he come inside?" Dozier opened the door. In front of him were two young men in workmen's uniforms. Each had a full beard and mustache. One carried a leather bag. "I told my wife, don't worry," Dozier recalled, explaining that the plumbers were trying to determine the cause of a water leak in the building. Judy had used their washing machine earlier in the day, and Dozier led the men toward the appliance. "Il termo fissone?" the plumber asked. Dozier did not have any idea what a termo fissone was. He headed into the library to get a dictionary and was looking for the translation when he was attacked. The leader grabbed him from behind. Dozier swung around just in time to see that the man had backed up. "I was looking down the barrel of a pistol," he recalled. The man pushed Dozier. Dozier struck back, and the two began fighting. The second man joined in, punching Dozier until he almost lost consciousness. He lay on the floor, an eardrum ruptured and bleeding from open wounds on his forehead and cheek. "When I looked up, I saw they had my wife on her knees with a pistol to her head. That's when the fight was over," he said. The kidnappers tied up Judy, gagged her, and put heavy tape over her eyes. They bound the general's ankles with rubberized elastic bandages and heavy packing tape and taped over his mouth. With guns drawn, they ordered him to his feet. Using walkie-talkies, they summoned two accomplices who arrived with a large steamer trunk on a mover's dolly. With a gun to his head, Dozier climbed inside. He was rolled down the hallway and into the service elevator. Outside on the street, additional accomplices waited in a blue Fiat van. The general's trunk was loaded into the back. The door slammed shut and the van sped away. General Dozier had been kidnapped by a Marxist-Leninist paramilitary group called the Red Brigades, a terrorist organization whose stated goal was to foster revolution in Italy and force its withdrawal from NATO. The Red Brigades had been conducting kidnappings and murders for a decade, the most notorious of which had occurred 2 years before. In March 1978, the group ambushed and kidnapped former Prime Minister Aldo Moro. They held Moro for 55 days, then murdered him. Now the group had Dozier. Word reached Washington roughly 6 hours after the abduction. The Pentagon went into action. Every moment mattered. The FBI offered a $2 million reward for information that could lead authorities to the general. A joint Special Operations Command team left for Italy. In Washington, Dale Graff was deeply concerned about Dozier's abduction, as were many of the other individuals involved. 5 days after the kidnapping, an Arabic speaker called the Italian wire service Agenzia Nazionale Stampa Associata to say that the Red Brigades claim responsibility for the death sentence and execution of the American general James Dozier, found guilty by the People's Tribunal, and that his corpse would soon turn up in a country village. At Fort Meade, Graff worked remote viewing sessions with Joe McMonagle, Hartley Trent, and Ken Bell, all three of whom had strong perceptions that General Dozier was still alive, still in the same place, and not being moved around. Every remote viewer was enlisted to try to pinpoint where in Italy the general was being held, but the multiple sessions produced an overload of vague and disparate information. Dozier was being held near a small Gothic-style church with a watchtower nearby. He was in a large house with a tile roof in the rolling countryside with a domed structure and a large river nearby. He was in an open space near the water or a shoreline with lots of buildings close together, towers and yellow hills, like sand. Or in a dome-shaped building near a shoreline and water with machinery nearby. Graff culled the information to narrow search parameters and home in on what might be significant and what was merely noise or analytical overlay, according to protocols SRI had developed for the Army. As time ticked on, the possible locations grew more scattered and less clear, and Graff feared that with every passing day, the noose grew tighter and time was running out. The Red Brigades were known killers. To make matters more complicated, a raft of unsolicited information from civil sector psychics flooded into the Pentagon. Declassified logs indicate that a trio of psychics living in Kent, Washington, insisted they knew where Dozier was being kept. He is dressed as a shepherd on a mountain tending his sheep. Please contact us, they wrote. The general had been in captivity for 2 weeks when a powerful snowstorm brought the city of Washington to a near standstill. With 21 inches of snow on the ground, all government employees who were not in security or facility maintenance were advised to stay home. This included Dale Graff. Not one to sit inside, Graff ventured outside to hike through Arlington National Cemetery. He put on his snow boots, grabbed his new 35mm camera, and swung by a 7-Eleven to get a coffee. It was 8:30 in the morning, sunny and clear. I was taking photographs when suddenly I got this overwhelming feeling. I've got to go to the office, he recalls. The subways were closed, and it was a 4-mile walk. Graff set out, trudging through the deep snow, to the DIA office in Arlington, across the river from Georgetown. At the front door, the guard asked him why he was there. I wasn't about to say I wasn't exactly sure why. So instead, I said I'd come in to catch up on some work, he responded. He was standing in the office looking around when he heard a phone ringing in Jack Verona's office. It rang and rang 10-11 times, recalls Graff. This was long before the days of answering machines. I thought, someone is really trying to get through. It must be important to let it ring that many times. Graff walked into Verona's office and picked up the telephone. The voice on the line said something like, "We're calling from the Pentagon. We need to talk to someone who knows about remote viewing." Graff said Verona wasn't in, But you've got one of the right guys. That's me. The person told Graf the situation was urgent and asked, can you come to the Pentagon and explain this program to us? Graf called Verona at his house to make sure he was authorized to conduct this briefing. Verona told him to head over there at once. Public transit was finally running. Graf took the metro from the Rosalind stop to the Pentagon. The Pentagon parking lot was empty. He'd been instructed to go into a classified briefing room in the basement. When he arrived, the room was full of army brass, Graf recalls. I learned later this was the first grouping of Delta Force. They'd just been mobilized for quick reaction response to go anywhere in the world. One of the army officers asked Graf to explain what remote viewing was. Graf talked and the men listened, took a few notes, and thanked him. The way Graf recalls the meeting, the officers got up as a group and left him sitting alone at the table. A few minutes later, a colonel came in. He began making insulting remarks about remote viewing, recalls Graf. This is terrible stuff, he said. Nobody believes in this crap. It was very confrontational. I remained calm, showing no defensive responses, and I wondered if it was some kind of psychological test. After a while, the colonel left. The original group returned. Can you travel to Italy starting tomorrow evening? One of the officers asked. For a few moments, I was speechless, remembers Graf. Travel to Italy. Regaining focus, he said, sure, except he didn't have a passport. The officer told him not to worry, that the Pentagon could provide that, and a translator too. He explained to Graf that the idea was to see whether the Army could use remote viewing operationally in the field. Graf headed home and packed his bags. The following day at 6 p.m., with the approval of DIA Director General Edmund R. Thompson, Graf and an Army translator headed to Washington National, where they caught a commercial flight to Italy. When they landed, they drove to the U.S. Army garrison in Stuttgart. There, Graf and his translator were told they were being recalled. Since they'd left Washington, the commander of the American forces in Europe had decided that there were too many people in the field working on the Dozier case. The military staffer who met them at the airport suggested that Graf and his translator turn around and catch the next flight home. Graf responded that since he was already there, he should at least have a brief discussion with the commander in charge. The staffer went away and came back. The commander will give you 5 minutes, the staffer said. Make it to the point and fast. Graf walked into the commander's office. Big desk, tough-looking guy, in charge of the Dozier operation, Graf recalls. He made a pitch for the merits of using extrasensory perception in a search and rescue operation. He told the commander he was convinced that remote viewing could add value to the effort to locate Dozier. The commander interrupted, Graf recalls. I'm not sending anybody down there, he said. Graf recalls asking the commander whether he could at least explain the phenomenology involved. The commander interrupted him. He told me to stop right there. He said, I don't believe a word of what you are saying. I know all about J.B. Ryan and that it's a bunch of fraud. Then came the part Graf found illuminating. He said to me, I know it's hard to believe, but my aunt lived in Durham, where Ryan had his parapsychology lab at Duke University. The commander's aunt was part of a carpool of locals who knew all about this J.B. Ryan fellow and his fraudulent claims of ESP. In the early 1980s, J.B. Ryan was still considered the most famous parapsychologist in modern American history. Starting in the 1920s, at the Institute for Parapsychology in Durham, North Carolina, he'd performed tens of thousands of now-famous ESP experiments with Zener cards. But in 1974, One of his assistants, Walter Levy, was caught cheating. The experiment involved testing rats in an apparatus designed to see if they could use extrasensory perception to increase the number of pleasurable brain stimulations the apparatus was rigged to deliver. When Levy's research assistants spotted him tampering with the lab equipment, they rigged up a recorder and caught him on videotape. When confronted with the evidence against him, Levy confessed and resigned. The scandal became fodder for anyone skeptical of Rhine or his parapsychology research, skeptics who included the commander's aunt. What fascinated Graf was how a person's strong opinion is often shaped by the strong opinion of someone else. Quickly and to the point, Graf filled in details of the Rhine cheating scandal, as well as details of some of the work Rhine had done for the Navy. Graf recalls the commander taking a moment to digest what he'd said. He said, "Tell me more," Graf recalls. The two men had a debate about ESP for roughly 25 minutes. Graf remembers the high-ranking senior officers in the room sitting patiently, but also eyeballing a clock on the wall and giving him puzzled looks. "Here was a commander who knew his stuff," explains Graf. "Great men don't become great leaders by being narrow-minded. He wanted knowledge and I had the information. He was genuinely interested in what I had to say." As the meeting ended, Graf recalls the commander's parting remark. "There's one thing I really need to understand," he said. "This precognition stuff, that's a tough one. I was with you until you got to that. That part is beyond belief. You lost me there." Graf told the commander that there was no theoretical explanation as of yet, and that ESP research was still in the hypothesis or conjecture stage. "One hypothesis," he recalls saying, "has to do with electromagnetic modeling of the phenomena. Another involves quantum entanglement, or what Einstein famously referred to as spooky action at a distance." Then Graf presented in basic terms how the electromagnetic wave equation has two potential solutions involving the forward and backward movement of time, that although the reverse or precognitive solution is actually ignored in practice, and that some emerging concepts in quantum physics permit precognitive phenomenon. The commander interrupted, remembers Graf. "Go south," he said. On the commander's authority, Dale Graf was now an ancillary member of Delta Force. He and his translator headed south to Vicenza, where the 584th Military Intelligence Detachment was working with the Joint Special Operations Command to find and rescue General Dozier. Graf was given a working space in a secure annex to the main headquarters. The place was teeming with people coming and going, operators, analysts, officers, and staff. From his secure telephone, Graf worked on information from the remote viewing unit at Fort Meade. Halfway across the world, in room 2654 at Fort Meade, Joe McMonagle worked session after session. He saw Dozier in an apartment inside a building in a town he identified as Padova or Padua. He drew details of the inside of what he thought was the apartment and the exterior of the building. But as the DIA office would later learn, the time difference made direct communication difficult. The action officer at DIA was out sick, and McMonagle's information never reached Graf in Vicenza. As the days wore on, the pressure ratcheted up as the general's abduction passed the 30-day mark. In Italy, when Graf tried to sleep, he experienced strange, vivid dreams. The Dozier operation was a life-or-death situation. "In a dream state, I began to get impressions," says Graf. "It was as if he were doing remote viewing sessions himself. I saw the general upstairs in a room above a grocery store. I said to my translator, he's in Padua. Graf wrote up his experiences and gave them to his superior in Vicenza. I didn't identify myself as the remote viewer, he remembers. The following day, a U.S. signals intelligence team provided Italian police with information that led to the capture of key informants with direct knowledge about the activities of the Red Brigades. The informants' data broke the case and led Italian special forces to the exact street address where the general was being held, above a grocery store in Padua. The largest manhunt in Italian history ended with 10 men from Italy's Central Operative Security Nucleus storming the apartment. Inside, Red Brigade's member Antonio Savasta was holding a gun to General Dozier's head. But before Savasta could pull the trigger, a commando hit him from behind with the butt of a machine gun, knocking him to the floor. The 42-day ordeal was over, and the general was alive and free. Dozier was flown home and given a hero's welcome. Ronald Reagan invited him to the White House for lunch. When the elation over Dozier's release wore off, Graf grappled with fundamental questions. It was distressing, really, he recalled in 2015. I had to ask myself, what good did ESP dreaming or remote viewing do? Once in the field, I learned quickly that there was no way to actually pass on any remote viewing information to the Italian search team. We had to wait until the operation was over to understand what information was correct. Yes, the location of Padua proved to be correct, but that was one data point in the volume of information that was coming in. It was the same old question again. How does one discern what is signal and what is noise? Yes, Gary Langford's precognitive information was remarkable after it became a fact. But what good did it do? It neither stopped the kidnapping, nor did it help locate Dozier once he'd been taken hostage. Back at DIA, Graf wrote up an after-action report in which he identified the positives and the negatives from the Fort Meade remote viewing involvement in the Dozier search. A few weeks later, he was invited to attend a conference with General Dozier at Fort Meade. The emphasis was on special forces, Graf recalls. I wanted to talk about remote viewing. I waited until the end of the Q&A, until after most of the audience thinned out. With just a few individuals remaining, Graf introduced himself to the general and asked whether he'd ever heard of the remote viewing program at INSCOM, the Intelligence and Security Command. Graf recalls Dozier asking if he meant ESP. Some call it that, Graf said. Dozier stated that the way he finally figured out where he was being held involved listening to voices and realizing that groceries were being sold. He said that later he heard his captors building a box. He thought it might be a coffin and started focusing hard on his wife, Judy, and his love for her. Dozier said he thought that if he concentrated hard, she might pick up on his thoughts, like a lighthouse or a beacon sending out a signal. Not using any names, I told him that two remote viewers had given us the name Padua. He seemed genuinely interested, Graf recalls. I did not say one of the remote viewers was me. Graf returned from Italy to find himself in the middle of a heated battle over the military's involvement in remote viewing. The existence of the classified program had made its way into the upper echelons of the Defense Department, various congressional intelligence committees, and the White House National Security Council. The subject matter was so contentious, the U.S. Army using psychics in military operations, that individuals felt compelled to take sides. The Undersecretary of Defense for Research and Engineering, William Perry, stated in a memo that it was not appropriate for Army to fund technology programs aimed at scientific development of parapsychology. Congressman Charlie Rose, a Democrat from North Carolina, disagreed. "It seems to me that it would be a hell of a cheap radar system," Rose said during a debate on psychic research in a House Select Committee on Intelligence meeting for which he served as chairman. "And if the Russians have it, and we don't, we are in serious trouble." Religious elements crept into the debate. A fundamentalist Christian group, aligned with a powerful congressman, declared remote viewing to be the devil's work and lobbied to have the program canceled. CIA Director Stansfield Turner, a Christian scientist and former Navy admiral, did not allow theology to get in the way. In an interview in 2002, Turner said, "When I was first introduced to this idea of parapsychology, I was very skeptical. Then I began to think about it, and we all know of people who seem to have some kind of psychic powers." Leading the charge in support of the remote viewing program was Senator Claiborne Pell, a powerful Democrat from Rhode Island and a ranking member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. A former Foreign Service officer who had worked behind enemy lines in Nazi-occupied Hungary, Pell was a proponent of extrasensory perception and reached out personally to Graf, offering his support. National Security Council member Lieutenant Commander Jake Stewart of the Office of Naval Intelligence had been impressed when he first learned about the remote viewing program during the MX missile basing era, and like Senator Pell, offered his unwavering support. Stewart had direct access to the president and other leading White House officials. Polemics aside, for the Army's INSCOM program to survive, it needed clients, meaning operational requests from the military and intelligence services. In the spring of 1982, 2 months after Graf's return from Italy, the program caught the break it needed after Lieutenant General Lincoln D. Fowler, director of the National Security Agency, was given a briefing. Fowler saw extrasensory perception as a form of signals intelligence and believed in its potential operational value. In April 1982, he assigned the remote viewing unit at Fort Meade a dozen new tasks. But the crux of the matter was that the program's longevity depended on the quality of intelligence that Army psychics could provide. If the results were authoritative, the program would thrive. That's the way the U.S. military operates. During the Vietnam War, for example, a majority of generals opposed cutting-edge technology, namely electronic warfare, being developed for combat applications. In their nascent stages, the sensor systems, computers, and overhead satellite technologies being pushed onto battlefields left many generals asking how electronic systems could possibly benefit their soldiers on the ground. Despite intense criticism, these technology concepts were pursued by the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, and other military laboratories, and they eventually led to a revolution in military affairs. Extrasensory perception was hardly a new technology. It was an ancient discipline linked to magical, mystical, supernatural, and occult ideas. But how to uncouple ESP and psychokinesis from their primitive, pre-science past? The Army had a plan. The U.S. military is built on principles and protocols. It loves manuals, directives, and codes. The Army decided it would develop a manual and train soldiers to become remote viewers. It would jettison the idea that people were born psychic. Remote viewing would henceforth be regarded as classified Army tradecraft. The job of creating the manual was assigned to Hal Puthoff and Ingo Swann at SRI. The two began developing a system to train soldiers and civilians with the U.S. Army in a six-stage process called Coordinate Remote Viewing, or CRV. While Puthoff and Swann wrote the CRV manual, Fred Atwater, now serving as branch chief, traveled to Fort Huachuca in Arizona to locate two military intelligence officers who would be trained personally by Swann in CRV techniques. The men he chose were Captain Rob Cowart and Captain Tom McNear. In 1982, both men were read onto the classified Grill Flame program. The plan was that after Cowart and McNear had been trained, they would become the program's CRV trainers. The timing was fortuitous. In 1982, there was a new commanding general at INSCOM, Major General Albert Stubblebine, a powerful figure who welcomed unconventional beliefs. His purview was vast. Stubblebine was in charge of all of the Army's strategic intelligence forces around the world, including signals, photographic, and human intelligence, along with counterintelligence. "They all belong to me," Stubblebine said in an interview in 2009. "I was supposed to find out what the enemy was doing before the enemy did it, so that we could take action against the enemy. That's intelligence, before the fact," he said. General Stubblebine had a long-standing interest in anomalous mental phenomena. He had studied altered states, out-of-body experiences, extrasensory perception, and precognition. These, he said, were not hocus-pocus, not superstitious, and not occult. They were mechanisms that consciously tapped into human potential. This was human technology, Stubblebine insisted, and like all technology, it needed to be researched, developed, and advanced. Under a psychoenergetic phenomena program banner, with access highly restricted, a series of new programs related to extrasensory perception and psychokinesis emerged. Some of these efforts sought to use the mind to affect biological systems, including one's own. This new work at INSCOM would resemble programs going on in China under the leadership of H.S. Chen, in which the mastery of Qigong was seen as a pathway to such extraordinary human body functions as skin reading, clairvoyance, and psychokinesis. General Stubblebine set up an entity called the Advanced Human Technology Office. The man he chose to run it was Lieutenant Colonel John B. Alexander, a former Green Beret and Special Forces Commander in Vietnam, with a PhD in thanatology, the study of death. Chapter 17. Consciousness. The first time extrasensory perception and psychokinesis were written about in an official U.S. Army publication was on December 12, 1980. The article, titled "The New Mental Battlefield, Beam Me Up, Spock," was published in Military Review, the bimonthly magazine of the U.S. Army Combined Arms Center at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. The author was Lieutenant Colonel John B. Alexander. While the concepts may stretch the imagination of many readers, wrote Alexander, the possibility for employment as weaponry has been explored. To be more specific, there are weapon systems that operate on the power of the mind, whose lethal capacity has already been demonstrated. Alexander was not yet part of the Grill Flame program, nor did he have access to information about any of the CIA, DIA, or Army projects involving ESP and PK, now also being called Remote Action, RA, and Remote Perturbation, RP. Alexander's article was based on personal experience and open source information, material found in books and articles in the public domain, which in 1980 meant the library. The military establishment's initial response to Alexander's article was relatively subdued. Then Washington Post columnist Jack Anderson read the article and wrote about it in his column under the heading Voodoo Warriors of the Pentagon. Anderson surmised that the generals at the Pentagon were dabbling in the dark arts, using Ouija boards and the evil eye, and studying programs a Haitian witch doctor might try. The wire services picked up on the story and it went national. That's when the shit hit the fan, John Alexander recalled in 2016. Back in January 1981, Alexander recalls, he was sitting at his desk at the Pentagon, where he worked for the Inspector General, when an Army officer came in unannounced and highly agitated and began asking questions about the New Mental Battlefield article. This was one in a series of synchronicitous events, he says. Hardly prone to magical thinking, Alexander is a former Green Beret. From 1966 through 1969, he commanded Special Forces A-teams in Vietnam and Thailand, earning the moniker Assassin 6. After the war, he engaged in a variety of pursuits that kept his brain and body challenged. He climbed mountains in Nepal and swam with whales in Tonga. In an effort to understand human belief systems, he studied superstition, sorcery, and witchcraft around the world, interviewing witch doctors in Zimbabwe, shamans in Siberia, and tribesmen in New Guinea who still practiced cannibalism. What interested him most was how people faced fear and how people feared death. For his PhD in near-death studies, working under the celebrated physician Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, Alexander was a founding board member of the nation's first Children's Hospice International, where he facilitated the development of protocols to help terminally ill children face death without fear. No hospital wanted to touch this concept at the time, Alexander says, as if the idea of children dying of cancer was somehow taboo. Alexander embraced a topic that had been ignored by the mainstream, and for his pioneering work with terminally ill children, he received the President's Volunteer Service Award from Ronald Reagan. The angry fellow on the other side of Alexander's desk was from the Office of the Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence, U.S. Army. He wanted to confirm that Alexander was the author of the article Jack Anderson had recently written about in the Washington Post, and if he was, then surely he was aware of clearance procedures for military employees with regard to publishing. When Alexander showed him the appropriate paperwork, the officer reviewed the documents and left. By January 1981, John Alexander's esoteric interests had caught the attention of a high-level Army organization called Task Force Delta, not to be confused with Delta Force. led by Lieutenant Colonel Frank Burns and supported by several generals. Delta was an army version of a think tank, Alexander explains, whose purpose was to address the myriad post-Vietnam War problems the army was grappling with, including its own image. Task Force Delta believed that perception was a key component of everything, Alexander explains. With the right formula in place, the army could change the way its soldiers thought. One such case was the army's new recruitment strategy campaign. This huge success arrived on the heels of a decade of abysmal failures. In 1971, the Army's recruiting slogan was, "Today's Army wants to join you." Not only awkwardly phrased, it made little sense, and it turned out to be one of the least successful advertising campaigns in Army history. 2 years later, at the end of the Vietnam War, the slogan changed. Now it was, "Join the people who've joined the Army," which was almost as feeble. General Maxwell R. Thurman, a Task Force Delta participant, understood the power of messaging. In 1979, he helped create a new slogan, "Army, be all you can be." This crafty and empowering message would become one of the most memorable Army recruiting mottos of all time, and it remained in use until the War on Terror. Its success underscores the power of words to influence perception. Language, perception, and communicating the message were key components of Task Force Delta, but so were other, more extreme, out-of-the-box ideas. Nothing was too unorthodox to consider, recalls Alexander. Task Force Delta was an organization that thought so far outside the box that its members didn't know whether or not a box existed. In 1981, there were 5 people permanently assigned to Task Force Delta. Lieutenant Colonel John Alexander was a part-time participant. He'd been invited to join the group before he'd written the controversial article. The day after the awkward meeting about publication clearances, Alexander received word that the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense, a retired Army 4-star general named Richard G. Stilwell, wanted to see him. A lieutenant colonel being asked to meet with a 4-star general was an uncommon occurrence, since it bypassed the chain of command. Alexander was unsure what to expect. Stilwell was an Army legend. He'd participated in the Normandy invasion in World War II, served as head of the U.S. Military Assistance Command, Thailand, during the Vietnam War, served in the CIA, and as commander-in-chief of the United Nations Command in Korea. What did Stilwell want to see John Alexander for, he wondered. At 12:30 p.m. that same day, Alexander made his way to the general's office, located in the elite E-ring of the Pentagon, for the meeting. It was oddly informal, he recalls. The general wanted to discuss various forms of phenomenology I'd written about in my paper. The conference ended without a specific request, which also struck Alexander as unusual. Walking back to his desk in the Pentagon's C-ring, Alexander wondered what the real purpose of the meeting might have been. That afternoon, at a little after 4 p.m., an executive officer approached Alexander and told him this was his last day in the office of the Inspector General. General Stilwell had arranged for his transfer to INSCOM at Arlington Hall, Virginia. His new commanding officer would be Major General Albert Stubblebine. "I'd been formally moved into the psychic realm," says Alexander. In the early 1980s, a panel of scientists working for the Army Science Board had identified a major challenge facing the military institution. Machines were getting smarter, but humans were not. Sophisticated high-technology systems are changing faster than the human beings required to operate and maintain them, the panel found. The Army needed new ways to improve human productivity in order to offset what had officially been identified as the growing human-technology gap. The operational definition of human technology, wrote the board, includes strategies and actions which improve human capability and/or performance. The Army did not want soldiers to be all they could be. They wanted them to be better than that. At INSCOM, General Bert Stubblebine was the man in charge of developing human technologies that would be useful to the Army. John Alexander had been transferred to help him realize this vision. As part of a program called INSCOM Beyond Excellence, Alexander was now in charge of the Advanced Human Technology Office and would interact with Stubblebine's High Performance Task Force. General Stubblebine was a commanding figure. He was 6'3" with a shock of white hair, enormous ears, and a broad forehead. Colleagues described him as a dead ringer for the actor Lee Marvin. A West Point graduate, class of 1952, Stubblebine had a master's degree in engineering. He had spent the first decade of his military career in armored units and as an instructor at the U.S. Military Academy, where he taught chemistry. During the Vietnam War, he worked as an imagery analyst and became the third military intelligence officer to serve as a primary staff officer in a combat division. After the war, Stubblebine worked his way up through the leadership ranks, distinguishing himself with pioneering ideas in the new so-called electronic battlefield. By 1982, as head of INSCOM, he had 16,000 soldiers under his command. Protected by his broad authority, Stubblebine had no qualms about expressing his interest in all forms of anomalous mental phenomena, including extrasensory perception and psychokinesis among them. He once told a group of officers that his goal in meditation was to learn how to levitate. Members of the Advanced Human Technology Office traveled across the country on a quest to learn what factors motivated people to strive for greatness in performance and why. The team visited organizations as diverse as the Dallas Cowboys, the Menninger Foundation, Ford Motor Company, and Frito-Lay. They examined courses centered on New Age thinking, structured writing, the Lazarov learning method, the Cortex program, cohesion technology, and SALT, suggested accelerated learning teaching techniques. The team examined a multitude of New Age and self-help programs across America, including sleep discipline, neuro-linguistic programming, and Silva mind control, a self-help practice in which students are taught to rewire their subconscious using guided imagery. The goal was to sift through volumes of data, pare down the results, and identify the 5 best human technology programs that Army INSCOM could get behind. 5 programs to narrow the human technology gap and create soldiers who were better than they thought they could be. In the remote viewing unit at Fort Meade, Joe McMonagle was exhausted. Between 1981 and 1982, he'd worked on more than 100 intelligence missions targeted directly on terrorism, including ones in Africa, Europe, South America, the Middle East, and the United States. Ken Bell had left the unit, and just about everyone else was away training at SRI. That left McMonagle and Hartley Trent with a heavy caseload. Army personnel don't get overtime pay for longer hours or more work. Salaries are finite, set by rank and years of experience. There were requests coming in from NSA, CIA, FBI, even the Joint Chiefs of Staff. While this was good news for the longevity of the program, it also placed considerable strain on McMonagle and Trent. Remote viewing was grueling, intense work, the strain of which was exacerbated by the fact that someone working in a classified special access program couldn't tell anyone what he or she did all day. Even if he could tell, McMonagle was practical enough to know that most people doubted the legitimacy of psychic functioning and might even laugh at it. The pressure was taking its toll. To reduce the stress, McMonagle and Fred Atwater played racquetball at the Fort Meade gym during lunch hour. Normally a gentle game, it became what the two men called combat racquetball. Full body blocking was allowed, and so were body checks against the walls. Sometimes an audience gathered in the gallery upstairs. On one particularly intense day, the two men were on a roll, with one recovery after the next and the ball moving at what seemed like lightning speed. As one of Atwater's returns came at him hard, McMonagle twisted around to put a downward spin on the ball when, wham, his racket caught Atwater in the face, just over the eye. There was blood everywhere. Fred just sort of stood there a few seconds. His eyes looked very strange, recalls McMonagle. Then he fell down. I thought I had killed him. He hadn't, though the cut was serious enough that the two decided to stop playing racquetball. Atwater was fine, but without this regular exercise, McMonagle put on weight. Health problems kicked in, he says, then snowballed. The disc injury from the helicopter crash in Vietnam resurfaced, with cold and wet days feeling particularly hellish. In the office, he struggled to meet demands. Kidnappings, weapons assessments, the Iran-Iraq war. Special access programs were lonely. At least Hartley Trent could relate to